Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court, John Sauer on behalf of Doler and Judge May, the appellant's cross-respondents in this case. This case presents a particularly stark example of what is actually a fairly common fact pattern, and that is an employee who suffers from a disability and seeks recovery on the theory that he has a complete disability, is totally incapable of working on the one hand, while at the same time advocating to his employer that I can continue to working, pursuing to a reasonable accommodation. There's a very large, significant body of case law that presents a very similar fact patterns, and where there is a clear inconsistency between the two positions that the employee takes, the courts have uniformly, I think without exception, applied judicial estoppel or a similar doctrine and held that these employees cannot engage in that double recovery. I say that this is a particularly stark example for three reasons. First of all, the inconsistency here is very clear, especially when one looks at the course of representations that occurred during the months of the early months of 2011, January, February, March, April of 2011, where literally within days of each other, Mr. Vaca is, or Judge, then Judge Vaca is taking different conflicting positions on whether or not he can continue to work pursuant to a reasonable accommodation. Secondly, the plaintiff in this case is in many ways the most sophisticated possible plaintiff imaginable. Judge Vaca is not just a lawyer, he's actually an administrative law judge who specializes in hearing disability benefits. As the Eastern District said in its opinion in this case that's now vacated, Vaca's trial testimony might seem incredible because you would expect that a 19-year veteran ALJ specializing in disability claims would understand the difference between representing to a disability insurer that he cannot work at all and representing that he can work pursuant to a reasonable accommodation. So you have a very sophisticated plaintiff who really has no plausible excuse for adopting inconsistent positions other than the desire, the understandable, but desire to protect his personal financial interests. And then thirdly, we have a plaintiff who sought not double recovery, but actually triple recovery based on these inconsistent theories, because while he was simultaneously contending to his employer that he could continue to work, and then later testified at the trial in this case that he would have been willing to work for another 20 years, he was going to doctors and soliciting from doctors inconsistent statements about his ability to work. The opinions of Dr. Taylor in the Mayo Clinic outside of Missouri are just flatly inconsistent with the opinions he elicited from Dr. Sanders and Dr. Mannion, the St. Louis-based doctors. And he's submitting different doctor statements to the disability insurer at the same time that he's submitting conflicting statements to his own employer requesting a reasonable accommodation.
Is it significant to our analysis of judicial estoppel that his inconsistent statements regarding disability benefits were not in a judicial proceeding?
I don't think it's determinative for multiple reasons. First, one of the most important points about the applications and disability is that the fact that he was making those representations before he was terminated totally undermines the credibility of the explanation he later gave at trial and is giving on appeal, that the only reason I became totally disabled by the time of the dissolution proceeding was that my firing is what actually caused a decline in my health. That might have some credibility if all that had happened was firing, but actually he was saying exactly the same thing that he said sworn under oath in January and again in May of 2012 in the divorce proceeding. He was making exactly the same representations to the disability insurer in not sworn statements, but a statement that he signed. If you look at the January 3rd, 2011 application, he's signing an acknowledgement that everything he's saying is true and that he has read the provision warning him about the penalties of fraud before he signs that. So there's this very strong formal representation that's made. But I would add that, in fact, it is not required. In fact, the Missouri courts, candidacy of Fletcher case, citing the Kelcor case that actually Judge Teitelman wrote in the late 90s before he was on this court, both of those cases squarely hold that the statement that causes judicial estoppel does not have to be made in a judicial proceeding at all. And in fact, in the Kelcor case, Judge Teitelman relied on just out-of-court statements where this particular litigant had engaged in clearly inequitable behavior and said, look, even if it's based on an out-of-court statement, you are playing fast and loose with the courts. And this is very consistent with the numerous federal federal cases we've cited, many of them involve situations where the representation that was made in an application for disability benefits or similar, whether it's ERISA or workman's compensation or whether it's SSDI, the statements made in the application are themselves an independent basis for estoppel. So that it's relevant for two very important reasons. First, it completely undermines the credibility of the explanation he gave at trial, which is that for the explanation for the subsequent sworn statements in the divorce proceeding that he gave at trial, because he said, oh, well, it was only until 2012, after I had been fired, that was why my health regressed to the point that I could no longer work pursuant to a reasonable accommodation at all. The problem with that is we know that in January and in February and again in April of 2011, before he was terminated, he was making inconsistent representations that are fully consistent with the sworn testimony in the divorce proceeding to the disability insurer. And the only principle you can draw from these three different sets of sworn testimony in the trial in this case, sworn testimony in the divorce proceeding, and then these sort of not sworn but very formal, serious representations that are under penalties of fraud and that are designed to elicit a very significant financial benefit to him, the only conclusion that can be drawn from that is the conclusion that the Court of Appeals drew in its opinion, which is that the jury's award in this case necessarily suggests that his other representations were false and misleading.
What was the trial court's ruling on this issue?
There were two rulings. We raised it in a motion for summary judgment, and that went to Judge Durker, and he denied it. But in the opinion denying it, he said, but for the fact that the divorce judgment was later vacated on appeal on very broad grounds, but for that fact, there would be, quote, little doubt that judicial estoppel should apply in this case. And then it was raised again in a judgment notwithstanding the verdict, and Judge Bush again denied it on that ground. Then it went to the court. Yeah, sorry.
So there's no discretionary decision by a trial court that they were not going to apply it. It was on a misstatement. You're arguing a misstatement of law.
Absolutely right. We concede, I think, that abuse of discretion is the proper standard of view generally for the application of judicial estoppel. However, in this case, the errors that were made, both in the trial court and the very same error made again by the Eastern District, was to treat that second factor, judicial acceptance, as a absolutely, you know, logically necessary element instead of one of a set of flexible factors. And on that point, I would actually further refer the court to case law that discusses that particular factor. In addition to treating it as an inflexible prerequisite, there was an error of law in saying that an out-of-court statement cannot be a basis for judicial estoppel for the reasons I've already said. And in fact, if you look at Justice Ginsburg's opinion in New Hampshire against Maine, the logic of that second factor, the sort of successful persuasion factor, boils down to not, hey, this is an unjust enrichment doctrine, or we want to make sure people are not getting double recoveries. She expressly says courts regularly, not always, but regularly inquire to successful persuasion for the purposes of making sure that there's not a perception or an actuality that one of the courts is being misled. So the fact that the judgment in the divorce proceeding was later vacated on appeal, essentially because the Court of Appeals believed that there was no evidence to support anything, doesn't take away the fact that a trial judge in St. Louis County was successfully persuaded by the testimony that is flatly inconsistent with the testimony that was presented in this case. Even though that was vacated later on appeal, that doesn't take away the purpose of the successful persuasion factor, because successful persuasion is not an element solely because we want to stop people from getting double or triple recovery, which is the risk in this case, but because the purposes of this doctrine is to protect the judicial integrity of the courts. In other words, and that's why we, in responding to the preservation arguments, yes, Your Honor.
Get 2 points in regard to that. One, opposing counsel says this is a matter that has to be raised by counsel and preserved, and you say it's the court can also raise it sua sponte because it's to protect the judicial process. If you could address that, and then also, I know it's your position that the three factors in New Hampshire are discretionary factors. Are there? Is it just your view that whether you have all three is discretionary, or are there other particular factors you would identify for us that we should consider?
Addressing the first question first, as to preservation, yes, it is our position that preservation is not required because this is a doctrine that can be raised sua sponte. That is at least the logic of New Hampshire against Maine, which is in many ways the sort of modern leading case on this doctrine. But that's been expressly held in the cases we cited in our brief from other jurisdictions, matter of Cassidy and the, I think it's Elber or Eilber, the case, the recent case from the Supreme Court of Virginia, where the court implied at least that there may be a duty to raise this because judges really are supposed to be gatekeeping their own judicial integrity, so to speak. So it is our position. Now, I will say this. It is relevant that we raise it repeatedly in the trial court, because otherwise there could be an equitable counter-argument that we're sort of ambushing them or subjecting Mr. Vaca to unfair surprise. But this really was raised again and again. These inconsistent statements were raised in multiple things. They were formally raised as judicial estoppel in the motion for summary judgment and again in the JNOV. And then the factual issues underlying them were raised in the motion in limine. They were raised in the first motion for directed verdict. They were raised again in the second motion for directed verdict. I think that they're right in saying that judicial estoppel was not itself formally raised in the motion for directed verdict, which usually you would really want to see from the purposes of preservation. But given the equitable nature of this doctrine and its purpose of securing the integrity of the courts, we believe that that preservation was more than sufficient. In fact, preservation is not required at all. If there were an argument that there had been unfair surprise or ambush, that might be a situation. But everyone knew all about this issue when the case was being litigated in the trial court. And I forgot your second question.
The second one is, are there other factors beyond the three in New Hampshire that this court should weigh or consider?
That's a great question. I haven't thought about it in that particular through that particular lens. I think of it as it's a totalitarian of the circumstances test. And I think that the factors that in this particular case the court really should look at was, is there a direct conflict? That's, I think, in many ways the most important question, and that was emphasized by the Supreme Court in the Cleveland case. Is there a direct conflict between the representations that were being made? And when you put the divorce testimony together with the application for disability benefits, I don't think there's any way they can get out of that conclusion. And then I would emphasize that this is a extremely sophisticated plaintiff. His very sympathetic situation in many ways, I concede, but and it may be very understandable that he was, in the words of the Court of Appeals, he was engaging in strategic, intentional statements that were designed to protect his financial interests because he thinks he's in a very difficult situation. It may be very understandable, but it was also illegal and dishonest what he did. And those factors, along with the factors emphasized in our brief, I think indicate that judicial estoppel
should apply. Can you address this issue about the statute requires complete and total disability to get benefits, but opposing counsel argues that, in fact, they got incentive to work benefits, which are lesser and not total disability?
Yes, I can. And in fact, I would actually start by pointing the court to the actual stipulation that was read into the record in the trial. I think it's at page 1272 of the transcript. There were two stipulations. Their brief only quotes the second part of the stipulation that says that the long-term disability benefits were actually calculated pursuant to this return to work incentive. The first part of that, they have stipulated that the benefits were not based on a situation involving a reasonable accommodation. And I think that requires the conclusion that they were, in fact, long-term disability benefits. And I remind the court that the statutory standard to obtain long-term disability benefits is that the ALG must be so disabled that he is totally incapable, or her is totally incapable, of doing conducting any duties of the office. And what the court ought to focus on is not the manner or the kind of benefits that are awarded, because honestly, it's a mystery to me why Moser's came up with return to work incentive instead of full-fledged long-term disability benefits. What the court ought to focus on is what representations were made in order to procure these benefits. Judge Vaca was well aware that the statutory standard was total incapacity, and there's no plausible reading of the statements he made to the disability insurer other than that he was representing to them that he could not work pursuant to reasonable accommodation.
Thank you.
Before you sit down, I want to talk about what the court should focus on. You got three different suits going on here, right? What's being appealed here is the discrimination suit, right?
No,
so
retaliation.
What is the court to stop from considering in the discrimination suit? I mean, the disability is one thing, the marriage is one thing. What he alleges here is the discrimination because he had filed these previous suits. So what representation is the court to stop from considering in the discrimination suit? Now, the disability is one thing, the marriage is a different thing.
That That's a great question, Your Honor, and I would say that the issue on which he is stopped, it should be stopped, is the representation that he could have continued working. Because the inconsistent representation he made in the two other proceedings was, I'm totally incapable of performing any work. And if that were the case, he has no plausible basis for a discrimination or retaliation claim. If he cannot be employed, if he is literally unemployable because he cannot work even pursuant to a reasonable
Well, he could have a discrimination claim, but what he submitted on was the retaliation claim.
And I think that... yes, he did submit on the retaliation claim. However, that claim was premised on his testimony that he was capable of continuing to work. So I don't think that it is very true that he abandoned all the discrimination claims and submitted the retaliation claim, but I don't think that changes the fact that if he is held to his prior representations, that this was a fully justifiable termination.
And does that go to the matter of damages or to the matter of retaliation?
I believe that the entire retaliation claim should be judicially estopped. So it doesn't just go. I mean, we have arguments in the alternative that the damages should be reduced for very similar reasons. There should be a significant reduction of the compensatory damages. We've argued, and actually the Court of Appeals concluded, that there was no case to submit punitive damages. But our principal position is, under judicial estoppel, the entire claim should have been barred.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. To begin with, I believe and we assert that the claim for that Mr. Baca should be judicially estopped from making this claim has not been properly preserved for this court. This estoppel is an affirmative defense. It's set out in Rule 5508, and that is a well-honored, long-time accepted principle of law. This court, in Spalding v. Stewart Title, said that defendants must prove their defense as a matter of law. It's not this court's job to fix what wasn't raised at the trial court level. At the trial court level...
Well, if it's an affront to the court, why isn't that part of this court's job?
Well, Your Honor, there was no cross-examination on the issue of his ability to work. The defendants offered no jury instruction. They did not raise anything about estoppel in the directed verdict.
That's not for the jury. That's clearly judicial estoppel for the judge to determine, right?
Well, Your Honor, it is. But if you look at the doctrine and we go to the doctrine, first of all, it is not well accepted that judicial estoppel is imposed sua sponte. And actually, no Missouri courts have ever done that, Your Honor. And quite frankly, this court and all Missouri courts have basically, they have cited Zender v. U.S. and the New Hampshire v. Maine case. Now, appellant spent a lot of time on New Hampshire v. Maine, but I want to point out that in New Hampshire v. Maine, Justice Ginsburg did focus on the fact those were identical parties, and it was a boundary dispute between the states. And New Hampshire and Maine had the same boundary dispute along a river. And then New Hampshire got the idea they wanted it pushed to the shore of Maine for lobster. I believe it was for lobster fishing. And what Judge Ginsburg said is, these are identical parties, and we're going to hold them to the consent order they entered into in 1977. The boundary had been established, believe it or not, in 1740. With King George II, and then there was a consent judgment in 77. So my point is, what they're trying to do here is to stop this claimant from making a claim when, in fact, it's not identical parties. And there are the three factors. Let's go to that. To be successful.
Excuse me, counselor. Why would it necessarily have to be identical parties? Why wouldn't judicial integrity, the truth-seeking function of the court. Why should we permit a person to say to different parties a different answer to the same question just because it's better for their side? I don't understand why alignment of parties would be necessary. It seems like to me alignment of issues might be necessary.
It's not necessary, Your Honor, but why I point that out is that it was very clear in that case it was identical parties. I don't disagree, and the case law is not that it has to be identical parties, Your Honor. But what everyone has accepted in these courts here in Missouri and broadly every circuit, the one circuit who even didn't follow it, Sixth Circuit now is questioning and says they will, is they have adopted the three-factor test. The first factor is the party has to have been successful in persuading a different court to accept a position. You need judicial acceptance. This element was emphasized in New Hampshire v. Maine, and this element has not been met. Judge Vaca did not, he was not successful in persuading a court on his position.
Is it really an element, or is it just a factor for the court to consider?
I mean, it's one factor, Your Honor, and his divorce is still not final. He has not convinced a court and was not successful in persuading a court. The second factor is
but
it must
going
be
back, I want to go back to that, but they're not, he's not, it's not like he's required to show that. It's just something for the court to consider when determining this equitable issue of whether or not to consider.
Yes, Your Honor, but I believe that this element must be met. It essentially must be met, and that's what this
But that's you can't say yes and say, but I disagree. So Judge Powell is saying he doesn't think it must be met. It's a factor, maybe a really important factor to consider, but no cases have said there are things you have to prove that are elements. You're calling them elements. They've said you weigh and balance all these different things, and in one case one may be more important, in one case another. So to the extent you're saying it's dispositive here, I'm not aware of a case saying that.
I will tell you there are two Berger cases from the Southern District, and the second Berger case, the Southern District said because in the first case, Berger wasn't successful in persuading a court, that judicial estoppel didn't apply in the second case. So we do have authority in Missouri on this element that says you must be successful in persuading the other court. And in
this
case,
can you address why his persuading the trial court in the dissolution action was not sufficient as, or is not something relevant for our consideration, even though it was reversed on other grounds on appeal? He did get that benefit, and the
case
is still.
He got no benefit.
He got a benefit of a ruling, counsel, in his favor. I'm saying he didn't, it got reversed on appeal on other grounds. But why isn't that a relevant fact, whether or not it's dispositive?
It is relevant, but the problem here is it's not met. This criteria is not met. He has not received benefit. And the statement that he's had some kind of triple recovery is completely false. The record does not in any way establish that. In fact, Vaca was not awarded disability benefits. He was given a return to work incentive, $750-some-odd, because, specifically because he was capable of doing his job.
Counsel, what is he getting right now?
He's on his pension.
Is he getting long-term disability? He's not getting long-term disability?
No, Your Honor. He is on his pension. He had worked for the state as an administrative law judge for 18 years, and as soon as his pension, he qualified for his pension. That's what he received.
Can you explain his submission to for disability where he claimed he was fully disabled?
Yes, Your Honor. What happened, if you look at the fact pattern, none of this was done in a vacuum. The Department of Labor and Industrial Relations had questioned Judge Vaca's reasonable accommodation. He had been under an accommodation for several years. There was a lot of pressure put on him. They kept saying they had adopted literally a false narrative after an investigation.
And I understand his argument that he thought he was likely to be terminated, and so he was worried about protecting his income. But I want, if you could explain why he represented to the disability folks that he was completely unable to work, whereas in fact he then said he was able to work with accommodation.
It is, Your Honor, what this is, he had no choice. He felt pressured. He testified to that. The jury heard that. He wanted to work. He continued to express the view he wanted to work, but his employer was putting him in a position where he had no choice.
I understand, but that doesn't explain why he lied. It explains why he was concerned he got benefits. I mean, was he lying when he did that because he felt so pressured? Is that what you're saying?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe he was lying. I don't believe the statements are irreconcilable. I don't think they're contradictory.
Explain that to me, because it sounds like it is.
When he made the statement in his disability application, he, in fact, and the disability insurer found he qualified for disability, but he was working.
I know. But okay, when he applied, what did he say?
His application.
He said he couldn't work at all.
In his application, he said, I'm working under a reasonable accommodation, and I am going to continue to try to work under my reasonable accommodation, but I'm fearful that I'm not going to be able to do that.
And then he filed a supplemental or amended statement with the disability insurer, did he not, saying he was not able to work at all?
Yes, and Your Honor, in the backdrop of that, he knew he was getting an unfavorable review, and he knew he was targeted for removal from the court, and he did that the same day.
And at what point,
these things were not done.
At what point did he amend and say he was able to work? He was not unable to work except as an administrative law judge. At some point.
Yes, Your Honor.
Makes that statement as well.
That is true, because he had sought employment. That statement was made in the trial court in his divorce action. He had sought employment. He even got certified as a, you can get a special certification in federal, under federal law if you're if you're handicapped to get preferential treatment. He had tried to get ALJ jobs or similar jobs to what he had done for the state, and he was unsuccessful. And so his statement in the trial, in the divorce proceeding, it's important to point out two things. One, it was made after he had been terminated. He had been told by his employer, the state, you cannot work here. We are deciding you're disabled. You can't work here. And it's made 6 months, 7 months later. That statement was true on that date. But why would we let so the state escorts him out, they say, here's your hat, what's your hurry? And then when he says in a trial court, I can't work, my employer wouldn't let me work, now we're supposed to hold that against him, but it's made later. Okay.
Well, what was the evidence?
Yeah, he actually said in the divorce that he couldn't not only work at his current job, but he couldn't work in any other job.
The evidence that he said that he the pleading actually states that in his divorce pleading, and he also testified in that court almost a year later after he had been terminated by the state.
That he's permanently.
He had in fact been terminated based on disability because he had applied for disability. I mean, granted, even though let's remember this. He wasn't granted disability. He was granted a return to work incentive because he had shown he was capable of working. His whole termination was actually a culmination of pretext to actually remove him from office. They used the disability application against him. And that's why we're here today. We're saying that one, let's go back to judicial estoppel. He wasn't successful in persuading that court. Two, the statements were not irreconcilable. They are not directly not reconcilable because the testimony was made a year later. The pleading was filed after he had been terminated. Plus, we do not see that there's unfair advantage in any way to him. He did not ever get a triple recovery, as is suggested, and the record does not support that.
So you're saying that the change in circumstances was the 7 months and the fact of the change in his employment?
Yes, Your Honor. It's based on that. He also, to back up a little, he suffers from a form of muscular dystrophy. So this is the kind of disease that waxes and wanes. And people with these long-term diseases, it's something they manage, and at certain times they feel better than they do at other times. Stress adds to the problem. He actually testified to this jury that a large part of how he felt in that divorce proceeding had to do with his termination, his self-worth. He literally testified he was suicidal after he was terminated. He said that he thought the best thing he could do is take a gun and shoot himself and be done with this. That's how profoundly depressed this man was.
And did he timely amend his wrongful termination claim?
Did he? Yes, Your Honor, he did. He He amended his divorce pleading to say, I got terminated from the one job I could do.
No, but did he amend his wrongful disability claim?
His disability insurer found he could work.
Yeah, I know his claim. What he submitted, the question.
He submitted it.
No, okay.
No.
Doesn't he have a responsibility to do so?
Your Honor, he was interviewed by the disability insurer, and his doctors were examined. The whole record was examined. We actually had a representative of the disability insurer that was actually presented via her video testimony, and all this was presented to them.
What would be all the opposing counsel has asked us to find your judicially stopped from asserting he wasn't totally disabled because of his different representations, and you've made many arguments why we should not judicially stop him. But if I'm interested in following up on a question of Judge Breckenridge, if this court were to find judicial estoppel so he could not claim he was able to work, what would the result of that be? His claim was based on retaliation, that he was fired even though he could work, and he was not, in fact, totally disabled. So what of your claim would remain?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe there would be a bar based on judicial estoppel.
I understand
that. It may modify damages, but there's not a bar.
Well, why not? I'm asking. What would remain? Because your claim, you didn't submit your discrimination claim. You abandoned that and just submitted retaliatory discharge, that he was discharged because he had complained about discrimination.
Right.
So if he's
true.
Found to, in fact, have been discharged because he was. They said he's discharged because he was totally disabled, and if he's barred from denying that he's totally disabled, what would you have left of your claim?
Your Honor, first of all, we don't believe the statute provides that he couldn't do his job. He had represented, he did his job. Every witness who testified at trial acknowledged that he was, in fact, doing his job up to the day he was terminated. That's one. Two, judicial estoppel would not bar this claim, and it's not even asked that it really bar the claim. What they asked on summary judgment, which, by the way, I don't believe preserves the issue for this review, I think they had to ask for an indirective verdict, which they did not do. They didn't imply it either. It was a precursory directed verdict. That's where we believe that the issue of preservation fails, both on submissibility of punitive damages and on judicial estoppel. But what they sought is to limit damages. And the trial court looked at all these facts and ruled against them and said this is best sorted out by a jury.
Excuse me, counsel, how could the jury award him 20 years of damages because he what he would have earned had he worked another 20 years if we stopped him from claiming he wasn't totally disabled?
Well, we don't know that the jury awarded him 20 years of damages. What we do know is the jury heard evidence that he intended to work up till he was 75, but he didn't know. You know, none of us know the future. We know that. We also know the jury heard substantial evidence of the emotional harm done him and the fact that he felt broken. He felt humiliated. He felt devastated by what had happened to him. He had lost his purpose in life. So we don't know, as we stand here today as Monday morning quarterbacks some years later, that jury awarded him 20 years of pay.
You're out of time, Counselor.
Thank you very much, Counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. I know I significantly encroached the first time around, so I'll try and be really brief in rebuttal. Just to return to that last question, which ties back to the last question I was asked by Judge Draper, I think the state's position on this is if he is stopped from contending that he could be employed at all, they cannot possibly establish causation for any damages for a wrongful discharge on any theory.
Why not emotional damages? Why couldn't they just seek emotional damages?
I think the emotional damages would be kind of logically, would flow from the wrongful termination. So I think that that would bar even a claim for emotional damages.
So there would be no emotional damages if they wrongfully terminated him, just the emotional and the embarrassment of that?
Maybe the best thing I can say to that is he should be judicially stopped from requesting emotional damages on the grounds that he engaged in this inequitable conduct. So in other words, if it's a legal prerequisite to establish damages, in other words, he was saying as of January 3rd, 2011, I cannot possibly be employed. He was telling the insurer, he said, unfortunately, I am no longer unable to work. He represented to the insurer in that January 3rd application that my last day of work was.
But what if that's December not why 7th? You, what if they prove that's not why he was terminated? He was terminated because he had filed a discrimination claim.
I think that he would still have to establish causation. And I think that the causation argument would really undercut his ability to seek any damages. He wouldn't be able to say, I was wrongfully terminated because under the theory of judicial estoppel, he was literally unemployable going all the way back to at least January 3rd of 2011. So I think it would stop emotional damages as well. And then I just want to emphasize again, I would direct the court, just that without reading them into the record, the following exhibits to establish this. Plaintiff's Exhibit 36 is the application. These are the statements that he made. If you want to know exactly what he said, look at Plaintiff's Exhibit 36. That's the January 3rd application. Plaintiff's Exhibit 37, those are the doctor's statements he submitted in February. Plaintiff's Exhibit 47 is the letter from the Mayo Clinic contradicting the opinion of the doctors that was submitted in Plaintiff's Exhibit 37, and then look to the trial testimony, both the pleading in the divorce petition, which was not amended to allege that until much later that he could work as an ALJ, as well as the actual trial testimony in the divorce proceeding when he said, I'm like a cell phone, that's battery is on red, I'm too exhausted to do anything or focus on anything. They are inconsistent statements with the statements he made here, and I would encourage the court to apply the doctrine of judicial estoppel to bar any recovery for this particular point.
Did the trial court, although, allow the department to cross-examine Mr. Vodka on these statements, is that correct?
I don't remember exactly what was cross-examination was, but I believe we were allowed to introduce the statements in evidence. I believe, I'm confident there was significant cross-examination by Mr. Poole. I think right at the beginning of his cross-examination where he was confronting him with these particular statements.
And none of those statements, better question is, none of those statements were precluded by the court
Not to my recollection.
Okay.
And we emphasize in court that this is not a jury question. It's really a threshold question for the judge to make. Thank you.
Case will be submitted.